Hello, folks, and welcome again to another e-learning with E2R. Thanks for being here. Thanks for spending your time with us. We know you have competing priorities with your time, and so we truly appreciate your spending some time with us. So our topic today is You Be the Judge Redux, Canadian case law update. And there have been significant developments in Canadian employment case law, and we'll just get an opportunity to touch on some of it in a fun approach. Before we get started, here are a few reminders. If you have any questions during the presentation, feel free to use the chat box at the bottom right-hand side of your screen to type them out. We will do our best to answer them during the presentation, but if we don't get a chance to answer in the moment, we will reach out afterwards to schedule a call to speak with one of our advisors. In case you missed any of our past webinars, you can find the recordings over on e2rsolutions.com, and the PowerPoint presentation can be found on your member portal. Lastly, we take this opportunity to remind all of you that the information contained within our webinars is by way of overview only, not intended as an analysis of all areas of employment and labor law, and accordingly, we would ask that you not rely upon it as legal advice for any given situation. As always, please contact us for any specific questions related to the information in this webinar or any other topic, and for specific applicability of this topic area to your workplace. Our next e-learning with E2R, all right, everybody enter it right now, will take place on April 27th. Now, without further ado, let's begin. All right, by way of agenda, we will do, of course, as we always do, an introduction. Then we have some fun as we travel through our presentation today on You Be the Judge. And once again, we certainly suggest that you really scratch your chin and try to come up with the solution that you think is appropriate in the circumstances. So after introduction, we're going to talk about that's cause, I think. Then we'll go to resign or not to resign. That is the question. I want to mitigate my way. And that'll be interesting as we review the recent case law in that area. Don't let your bonus hit you on the way out. Perhaps one of the most dramatic developments, certainly in Ontario, is the, let's call it, interaction between what are called damages for reasonable notice and entitlement to bonuses pursuant to a bonus plan. The next one will be, I'm protected by the termination clause, right? We'll discuss that. Employment across oceans, to give you some a little bit more fun on the way out, and then finally, conclusion. Okay, by way of introduction, should be no surprise to any of you that litigation is uncertain. That's the reality when you litigate. Judges are human. Judges often will weigh their perception of the equities of the situation and indeed even their, to some degree, affinities towards the parties and make a determination that seems to fit conveniently within that assessment. And so as a result, you can often have, particularly in the employment area, decisions that run even counter to existing legal principles. It, you know, harkens back many years ago on an appearance before the Ontario Court of Appeal where essentially the panel looked at me and said, yeah, I get it, Mr. Dukoff, that legal principle is a sound principle, but come on. Your client operates in 49 different countries, and the plaintiff is a 26-year-old. Come on. That doesn't sound too legal, does it? But that's the reality of life sometimes in the employment arena. So, As a result, it can be uncertain. Getting it wrong is common. And that judges get it wrong, and you'll hear us and Alex and I talk today about the Court of Appeal reversing the trial court. Right? There are differences in perspectives amongst judges, differences in perspective amongst lawyers. So one of the reasons you use us is to weigh those differences to assist you with understanding and appreciating your risk and making a decision accordingly. So as you see from that next point, it's all too often you will have trial decisions overturned by appeal courts. Although we're pleased to say that we got a very recent decision here, argued out of our office here at the Court of Appeal, that upheld the decision that we argued at the trial court level on a very fundamental and now precedent-setting area of constructive dismissal. So we're certainly pleased to identify that. It can happen. So today we're going to give you a chance to rule on some new cases while also learning a few things about recent development in key areas of employment law along the way. So let's have some fun as we learn about new developments.
So as Stu mentioned, our first topic for discussion today is going to be a case where we're going to determine whether or not the employer had just cause to terminate an employee. So let's just jump right into the facts and the question that was posed to the court. So in this case, there was an employee with 12 years of service. They called in sick and they remained off work. And like many of our clients with our handbooks, there was a clear policy in place that said, if you're absent for 3 or more days, we are permitted to ask you to provide a doctor's note to support that absence, which is entirely reasonable. The employer not only had a policy, but they specifically requested on 3 separate occasions for the employee to provide that medical documentation. That employee did not provide documentation the first time, did not provide documentation the second time, and the third time, the employer clearly indicated that their employment would be in jeopardy if they did not comply with their third and final reasonable request for medical documentation. Surprisingly, the employee decided not to provide the medical documentation requested by the employer to support the absence, and they proceeded, unsurprisingly, to terminate that employee for just cause based upon insubordination and unsupported absences. Following the termination letter, the employee then provided a medical note, surprise, surprise, supporting the absence from work. The employee then decided that they were going to sue the employer for wrongful dismissal, and the question before the court was, did the employer have just cause to terminate that employee for failing to support their leave of absence? So we'll give you a second to consider that. This is to summarize: a clear policy, clear insubordination, an unsupported absence until after the fact, a just cause termination. Now, was that supported or not? Let's find out. Sorry.
I was just going to say right now as we wait for the proverbial drum roll and the answer, you can think about your own sort of Loblaws music in the background while we wait. We need to incorporate that in this presentation.
So if you assumed or guessed that the employer did have just cause to terminate, you would have been wrong. The court, unsurprisingly, agreed that the employer's policy was completely reasonable, that the request for medical information was completely reasonable. However, apart from being aggravated by the employee's refusal or unwillingness to support the absence, there was no provable negative impact to the employer. There were alternatives, aren't there always, to a termination for cause. And therefore, the court found that just cause was not established, that the employee was entitled to reasonable notice. Now, this is completely surprising to all of us here in the office. I don't know what more you need to do in terms of making the consequences clear. But we do need to be mindful of a couple of things here. One is that when assessing just cause, our courts will take a contextual approach, meaning they will look at all of the circumstances surrounding the employee's employment, prior discipline, all that sort of stuff. And if the factors weigh towards the employee, they typically won't uphold just cause. And that's why whenever we talk on the phone, we can't give any certainty, in most cases, what a court is going to say as it relates to just cause. And this court, quite frankly, pointed out to the employer that given the significant years of service, just cause wasn't a proportional response to the employee's failure to follow the reasonable policies of the employer.
Yeah, and you know, that's such a true point that Alex raises. And when a court looks at the overall contextual analysis, you know, they're going to look at the length of service. Was the employee overall a good performer? Is the employee subject to some personal circumstance that may be giving rise to sort of aberrant behavior? I mean, all goes into the hopper, and as Alex identifies, there is a, you know, let's sort of call it for what it is, a form of bias in many circumstances that the courts will view the circumstances through that prism. And as a result, it's, from an employer perspective, it's extremely difficult to establish cause unless you really have an egregious set of circumstances. So yeah, so you know, Alex, myself and all of us here, we look at these kinds of situations, shrug our shoulders and say, you know, a direct insubordinate act, persistent insubordinate act in a failure to produce required documentation. And as an employer, how can you in fact even trust that person on a go-forward basis if they're so prepared to act in such an insubordinate fashion? But here you go, where our court's going to look at it overall and go, hey, listen, you know what? Maybe you could have suspended. And sometimes courts will say that. And then, of course, the next question becomes, well, if you could have suspended, well, maybe that employee would have alleged constructive dismissal unless you have a policy that permits suspension. So it's tough to be an employer at various times. And so we just we call them as we see them. Don't shoot the messenger, but it is what it is out there.
Yeah, and just one more point on that as well. It's quite possible that if this case ended up in front of a different judge, they would have came to a different conclusion entirely. This could be a one-off situation, so it's not to say that the next time you have an employee that's refusing that, we don't have that position. But we need to be mindful that this is a possible outcome, especially if the person is a sympathetic witness, if they present well. All these factors, although shouldn't be taken into account by our courts, are. And so it's just a very fact-specific, moment-specific determination that we always need to be mindful of.
Okay, we just talked about termination. Now let's talk about the truth about resignations. So case number two. We've got a long service employee upset with an assigned duty. And so in response to that instruction to carry out that assigned duty, this particular long service employee via email says, hey, you're going to make me do it. I'm out of here. I'm not coming back. Following the email, the manager actually meets with the employee, and the employee alleges he did not confirm his resignation during the meeting, but the employer alleged he did. So we now have a dispute on the facts as to what happens in the follow-up meeting. But the employer's position is, following that meeting, that he was resigning, walked him out, took away his keys. The employee never sent any follow-up correspondence confirming he had resigned, but the employer did send a follow-up email accepting the resignation based upon the earlier email. So, we have a long-service employee, knows what he's supposed to do, sends a clear email saying, I'm not doing it, I'm out of here, if you're going to ask me to do it. He's a responsible employee, has his wits about him. Presumably, we're all adults in the room. We understand the consequences for our actions. So I'm assuming, therefore, he did resign as opposed to being terminated. I'll let you ponder that for a moment to determine which of those two findings you would make or which you would choose. Once again, insert music. and wind down the music. So what's the answer? No resignation. No resignation. Now, this one is probably not particularly surprising, certainly from our perspective. And why is that? Because the employee was clearly upset, and he said he would not return. So he's emotionally charged. He's a long service employee. He, from his perspective, is being asked to undertake a job task that he finds unacceptable. So, given his longevity there, probably perceived an entitlement to voice his opinion in a very forceful manner, which he did via email. Right? The employer and subsequent internal correspondence, and this is interesting, in internal correspondence indicated that the employee was going to be laid off in any event later in the year. So what does that say? Well, that says, look, the employer was going to have to terminate a long service employee later on in the year. What does terminating a long service employee typically entail? Big severance dollars, right? So here was the opportunity for the employer to what? Seize upon the opportunity of resignation and therefore disengage from that employee at no cost. Boy, couldn't be any luckier. Rolled sevens with the dice, right? So the court recognized that, right? And the employer said, hey, look, you've got a long service employee. You've got to seek clarity from that employee after the employee's had a cool down period. In other words, look, he was emotionally charged. Recognize that. You ought to have. And if he's a long service employee, my God, send an email saying, hey, Joe, do you really want to resign? Is that what you want to do? Let's make sure we have clarity now of intentions. But the employer didn't do that. So what's the basic lesson you learn from this and indeed other cases in the resignation area? That the resignation has to be clear and unequivocal. If a resignation occurs in the heat of the moment, it's not going to cut it. Not going to cut it. Right? You're going to, as an employer, have to seek that clarification following that emotionally charged moment to find out what the true intent is. And typically you have this kind of objective, subjective approach, which is, did the employee resign? Or, right, was there a subjective intention to resign expressed by the employee? And then objectively, did the employee do something following that that confirmed that intention? And as well, as you see here at the end of this page, that if the facts suggest that the resignation was convenient for the employer, then it just got too lucky for that employer, and the court's going to recognize it.
Our next case is on the issue of mitigation, and just by way of background for those that aren't super familiar with the concept of mitigation, mitigation is a concept that provides that a terminated employee does typically have a duty to go out and look for new employment, and if they do find new employment, generally an employer may get some credit for the severance that otherwise would have been owed under the common law. Now, that doesn't typically apply for a contractual entitlement unless the contract provides for mitigation, and also doesn't apply to the Employment Standards Act. The general principle in contract law, if I suffer a loss by virtue of a breach of contract, I need to take reasonable steps to minimize that loss. So with that in mind, let's look at this next case. In this case, we had an employee who worked for an employer that had a generous bunch of leaves, one of which was an educational leave. So this employee took advantage of that to pursue their PhD for a year. They didn't get their PhD, but upon the cessation of the leave, the employer terminated the employee for reasons unrelated to the leave at all. The employer, without cause, offered a 10-month package via salary continuance with a couple of obligations, one of which was to look for new employment. And if they did find new employment, that any discrepancies between the new salary with the new employer and the old employer would be paid for by the employer that just terminated the employee. 3 months after the termination, the employee was able to successfully secure an offer of full-time employment. But she wanted to keep pursuing her PhD, so she agreed with her new employer that she would start part-time while she completed her studies. Reasonably, her former employer argued, we're not responsible to pay you the difference between your salary with us and your part-time salary. Our responsibility should only be limited to paying the difference between your salary with us and your new full-time salary had you accepted the full-time offer. The employee argued, well, no. You have these educational leave policies. You view this as important. It was reasonable for me to pursue my studies and accept part-time employment. You need to pay the difference, the actual difference, not the abstract difference. So the court was then tasked with a question. Was the employer obligated to pay the difference between the prior salary and the part-time salary, or what would have been the full-time salary had she properly mitigated? Give you a second to that, and maybe instead of Loblaw's language or song, we'll hear a bit of Jeopardy, a little do-do-do-do.
Nice one. That's good, Alex. I like that one.
Here we go. Answer. If you said the employee failed to mitigate your rights, thankfully, this is an employer-friendly case for once, while the court said the employee was free, of course, to negotiate any part-time work with her new employer as she saw fit, it wasn't her former employer's responsibility to compensate for her preferences. As I noted at the top, the duty to mitigate requires an employee to take steps that a reasonable person would do to mitigate their losses, so essentially to maintain their income and position in the industry. In this case, the offer of full-time employment was in this employee's actual field. She wasn't taking a step back. She didn't need the education to kind of replace the same income, and therefore it wasn't reasonable for her to require her former employer to pay the freight. Now, there are cases out there that suggest that if an employee does need to retrain in order to mitigate or does need to update in order to mitigate, that an employer may be on the hook while an employee is seeking education, so that won't be seen as a failure to mitigate. But in this case, the facts definitely supported a failure to mitigate, and the employer was not responsible to pay the difference between her part-time salary and what would have been her full-time salary.
Okay, now we're going to get into some very interesting developments in the incentive compensation area as it relates to entitlement on termination. So let's start with our first set of facts, case number 4. Employee is a member of a long-term incentive plan, all right, and typically or often those plans require that you be employed for a period of time in order to reap the rewards under that plan. The plan clearly said that upon termination, the employee was denied any LTIP award because the plan required the employee to be actively employed. So the employee brings a wrongful dismissal claim seeking the LTIP award. In other words, the actively employed doesn't matter, and I should be getting the LTIP award. So the question is, was the employee entitled to an LTIP award? Once again, Jeopardy music, whatever music you find soothing, although some of the answers to this aren't so soothing, I'll let you think about it. All right, what's the answer? The answer is the judge concluded that denying an LTIP award based upon active employment amounted to bad faith, despite the clear terms of the plan. So think about that. At trial, the judge is saying it's bad faith to deny somebody this LTIP award, even though the employee is aware that the LTIP plan provides that you must be actively employed, effective the threshold date, in order to avail yourself of the benefits under that plan. But the court of, so this finds itself up to the Court of Appeal And the Court of Appeals said, well, no, we don't see any evidence of bad faith or that the termination was carried out to avoid paying the LTIP award. The LTIP plan was clear, no employer discretion, as it were. In other words, you had to be there. You had to have a four-year service requirement, which was clear and known to the employee. So we have a very favorable judgment, but we had to go to the Court of Appeal to get there. Once again, that kind of difficulty, that disagreement amongst judges, the disagreements among lawyers as it relates to entitlements and even a perception of what's fair and what's not fair.
We'll stay on this topic with case number five because there were further developments from or in this area. And so briefly in the facts here, an employee in their offer of employment was offered participation in the employer's discretionary, keyword discretionary, executive bonus program. In the first 3 years, the employee received bonuses under the discretionary bonus plan in significant amounts. So we're looking at $50,000 first year, $75,000 in the second year, and then $175,000 in the third year. The employee was subsequently terminated and argued that they were entitled to a bonus not up only to their termination date, but also through the reasonable notice period. And the employer argued, well, it was a discretionary bonus plan. We don't have to pay out the bonus up to the termination date or through the reasonable notice period. And so the court then had to decide whether or not there was, in fact, a bonus entitlement through the notice period. So again, cue the music, think about it, and let's see what the court said. So at the first instance, it was a motion brought by the employee. So they brought a quick little motion, not a full-blown trial, but a motion to a judge to rule on that particular issue. That judge decided there was enough information to make a ruling. And they ruled, along with the next appeal level, which was the divisional court, they found that no bonus was owed because the plan implicitly required employees to be employed during the assessment period. Essentially, how can I rule on a bonus or an amount of the bonus if the employee isn't there during the period in time which you would normally assess their performance to award a bonus? And our court, the motion judge, and the divisional court both said it's not up to us to determine the amount of that bonus. We're not going to award a bonus here. We have no basis to award one.
And Alex, correct me if I'm wrong, but in that case, wasn't part of the argument in favor of that position was that, well, hold it a second, you know, from a discretionary standpoint, had the bonus gone, you know, way down, right? It can go positive and negative, right? And to some degree, it's kind of like you're saying, how does the court evaluate whether the award would be increased or it'd be some very, very low amount, right? And so... It's the court saying, well, how can we impose our views on that or our perspective on that? We don't know, and there's no evidence really to clearly identify what that would be.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So that's why at those first two levels, the court said we're not going to award a bonus based upon that alone. There was a further appeal, and the court appeal did disagree with the motion judge and the divisional court on one important thing. They said we're not going to imply terms and conditions of the bonus plan. We're not going to imply that active employment was a requirement, because if you remember at the original trial level, the court said the assessment period is the assessment period. We're not going to assume, or we're going to assume that that means you need to be actively employed to get a bonus. And the court of appeal disagreed. They're not going to imply terms. There was no formal requirement ever communicated regarding participation, but thankfully they still refused to provide the employee with a bonus through the notice period. Because one, the employer didn't even argue that the bonus was being denied because there was no active employment. That wasn't even an argument that they put forth. And so there's no evidence brought forth that they refused the bonus on that grounds. And then even though the discretionary component of the bonus was questionable given he received it year over year, they looked at it and the reasonable exercise of discretion actually supported no bonus payment at all. There was no proof that his team that he was in charge of actually worked well enough to actually deserve a bonus in that year. So they found that they could, in fact, look at the circumstances, and based upon those circumstances, rule that there was no basis to award a bonus. So in essence, the Court of Appeals said we're not going to infer terms, and in fact, we can determine if a bonus was owed. And in this case, it wasn't owed, and it had nothing to do with active employment or not. There just was no basis to award a bonus, which is interesting given the next case that Stewart is going to be talking about.
Right. So let's think of it in one way. So it, essentially what the court just did in that case that Alex describes is they look at going forward. I don't care what he got in the past. He got 3 years of great bonuses. Fantastic. We clap our hands. But once he's terminated and we're looking forward to his entitlement on a reasonable notice, entitlement going forward, well, it's a discretionary bonus. We're not just going to look at historically and then just extrapolate that going forward. There was evidence clearly before the court that he wouldn't have been entitled to bonus over the course, and the court agreed. Now let's look what happens. Okay. So we have in case number six, we have an employee participates in a bonus plan. And what does the bonus plan say? And probably many of you in your bonus plans right now have a limitation regarding active employment. In other words, if you're not employed at the time of the payout, you don't get it. Okay? I could even read that in French, and I would understand that. Right? In other words, it's clear. I know as an employee, I don't get it if I'm not actively employed. That's the way that I could try to negotiate as an employee something more favorable. But if I don't, I don't, like any other term of the employment relationship. All right. So presumably then, if I'm not actively employed at the time of payout, and I'm not entitled, right? And that's what came up in this case. So let's ask ourselves the question, was the employee entitled to a bonus? As Alex says, cue Jeopardy. Jeopardy's the music I think that's coming into my head more often than not now that Alex raised that one. I think it's a good one. Okay? And the decision. Nope. The big buzz. Eh. The lower court found no bonus was owed based upon the principles we just learned. But what happened? It found its way to the Court of Appeal. And what the Court of Appeal said, no, we don't agree. We don't agree. We don't think active employment saves the employer from that obligation. And here's why. When we're talking about wrongful dismissal awards, what we're talking about is what that reasonable notice entitlement would be for that employee from the date of termination. So what's an employee actually suing for? We're suing for damages. Damages mean make me whole, assuming the breach didn't occur of your obligation, employer. So if it's characterized as damages, then the court looks at it and goes, okay, arguing it or seeing it from the perspective of damages, which is to make the person who's the victim of the breach whole, as though the breach never occurred, okay, what would the employee have earned over the reasonable notice period? And if the employee would have earned a bonus, how does that limiting language, you have to be actively employed, save the employer from that obligation? According to the Court of Appeal, it doesn't, because the principle of damages means you have to make that person whole as though the breach didn't occur, despite the limiting language of the bonus. So, the Court of Appeal developed, as you see there, a two-step test. What are the employee's common law entitlements, including whether during that notice period the employee would have been able to participate in the bonus? And if so, whether the language in that bonus plan unambiguously alters or removes the employee's common law entitlement. Okay, so that's where the court is saying you better have very good language in your bonus plan to deny the employee the bonus entitlement as part of his or her common law entitlement to reasonable notice. And without getting too, I know it gets difficult and it's hard as you hear all this information sometimes to synthesize it, but distinguish what we're saying right now from an employment contract with a termination provision, because that, we'll have discussions with you if that arrives, that's a distinguishable feature versus this discussion right now. But this is a watershed departure from what the perception was as to the enforceability of a bonus provision that said you have to be actively employed. So this decision is certainly being applied in Ontario and now certainly seems to be the prevailing law. So what are some of those takeaways? You want to make sure the bonus plan is incorporated into the written terms of employment, brought to the attention of the employee before the commencement of employment, so the terms are well understood as part of the overall offer of employment. The limiting language has to be very clear, very, very clear. Always have a termination provision that ousts the common law. All right, so remember, when you incorporate a termination provision, you are removing this whole discussion about common law entitlement and damages, and addressing any bonus payments beyond what would be statutorily required. And that's a sort of another layer, as it were, that we'll have discussion with you sort of one-on-one, because that can be a little bit confusing. Now, this final point, an important point, if the plan requires active employment and there's a valid enforceable termination provision that excludes the common law, unearned bonus payments are likely not owed on both a prorated basis to the termination date or through the common law reasonable notice period. That point is the point that we want to underscore here, that last point. Once again, if you have a plan that says you have to be actively employed, but we also have an enforceable termination provision in our employment agreement, we have successfully ousted the common law, and in all likelihood, both an unearned bonus payment through the date of termination and through the common law period will not be available to that employee.
Our next topic is very timely on what we were just speaking about regarding having valid termination clauses, and I'm sure as many of you are probably sick of hearing from us, we have had numerous discussions with perhaps all of you related to specific language requirements for termination clauses, what may or may not be enforceable, and how that has changed throughout the years based upon some of these cases. So we're going to examine some of the new cases on this issue related to the termination language. Let's just jump right into that first case, number 7. And because language is so, so important in the eyes of our courts, we've reproduced the actual clause here for you to get a sense. So I'm just going to read it very quickly. In this employee's contract, it said, your employment may be terminated at any time without cause upon the provision by FTIC, which was the employer in this case, of the minimum notice of termination or pay in lieu of notice, benefits, and if applicable, severance pay prescribed by applicable employment standards legislation. The provision of such notice or pay in lieu of notice, benefits, and severance pay constitutes a full and final satisfaction of all rights or entitlements which you may otherwise have related to the termination of your employment, whether pursuant to contract, common law, statute, or otherwise. And so the employee was not satisfied with just getting the minimum amount of notice. And in many employment standards provision, so Ontario, in this case Alberta, BC, there is very clear language in those particular acts that says we set the floor, but an employee is always permitted to seek more notice under the common law. And so that language is specifically outlined. And so this employee argued, yes, 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 the employer said I'd get my minimum standards, but the Employment Standards Code in Alberta allows me to seek more notice under the common law. I don't think they limited my entitlements by virtue of the language here. And therefore, this clause is ambiguous. I can still seek more notice from my employer in this case. So I'll give you a couple seconds to think about whether or not that employee was successful in that argument. And the answer is going to be they were unsuccessful in that argument. Now, in other words, the employer did a very good job ousting a common law claim based upon the clear language of the clause. And the reason why this was an issue at all is because there were existing cases, especially in Alberta, that said, for example, a lot of employers have provisions that say we will provide you with notice of termination in accordance with the Alberta Employment Standards Code or the Minimum Employment Standards Act. If you just say you're going to comply with the Act, our courts have said that's not enough. We're not going to infer that you have limited them to the minimum. In this case, the employer used the minimum, saying you're going to get the minimum and essentially nothing more. If your clauses say you are going to get the Employment Standards Act and doesn't oust the common law, doesn't use the word minimum, our courts have said that an employee is not prevented from seeking more. So in this case, luckily, the employer referenced all the important points of notice, severance, and did limit it to the minimum amount, not in compliance with. And they also went one step further, which we do in our contracts, that specifically ousts any common law entitlement. Essentially, you are not entitled to common law reasonable notice if we comply with this provision. And now Stuart's going to speak to, I'm going to just go through a couple more key points just to highlight that. When you're drafting your termination provisions or having us draft your termination provisions, we want to clearly limit the employee to the minimum amount, not just the amount set out in employment standards. If we don't use the word minimum and we don't oust common law, again, there is an argument to be made that they are entitled to common law notice because the acts do provide for the ability to seek that. And then we also want to go that one step further, like we do, that does expressly exclude any common law entitlement.
Okay, here we go with another one on, and once again, as Alex underscores, what the courts ultimately grapple with, I mean, is language. That's what it is. A contract dispute is what? A contract dispute is the parties to the contract disagree on what the language means, or what you have here is an employee who understood what the language meant without question. Without question. The employees in most of these cases absolutely understood what the bargain was. But then they rely on case law, developing case law, to take the position that the language used in the contract fails to satisfy, in essence, the minimum requirements legislatively, and therefore that provision is not enforceable. So remember, let's step back for a second and really think about this. Both parties understood exactly what they entered into. The employee understood exactly what he or she was entering into. But then when the relationship typically is disengaged, the employee is now looking to find a basis upon which the particular term that impacts that employee is no longer enforceable. So talk about bad faith. That is really, in many respects, a bad faith exercise by the employee, given that the employee clearly understands and understood, and despite that understanding, is in effect attacking the applicable provision of the agreement. So let's see what happens. In this particular case, here's the termination provision. Your employment at any time, without cause, upon providing you with 2 weeks' notice of termination, okay, or pay in lieu thereof, okay, excuse me, for each completed year of service or partial year. So I get 2 weeks per year of service or partial year of service with the company. Okay, sounds pretty good. If the company terminates your employment without cause, the company shall not be obliged to make any payments to you other than those provided for in this paragraph. 2 weeks per year of service. Employee, do you understand that? Absolutely. Does employer understand that? Absolutely. The payments and notice provided for in this paragraph are inclusive of your entitlements to notice, pay in lieu of notice, and severance pay pursuant to the Employment Standards Act 2000. Well, what's the intent in that line? Well, the intent in that line is to say to the employee, look, everything we're giving you here incorporates your minimum entitlements under the Employment Standards Act. Can it be any clearer? That was the mutual intention of the parties. Okay, so what happens? What does the employer do? Well, the employer relies on that provision when it terminates the employee, but the employee says, not enforceable. Forget it exists. Forget I agreed to it. Irrelevant. I want the common law to apply, which is what applies in the absence of a termination provision or in the absence of an enforceable termination provision. And based on my common law entitlement, based on my years of service, etc., I say I'm entitled to 12 months. Feels like bad faith, doesn't it, from the employee perspective? But that's what the employee's doing, trying to get as much as he or she can, arguing that, what I agreed to before, forget that. Irrelevant. So what does the motions judge say? Because it goes on a motion, these kinds of cases, certainly in Ontario and BC, can go before a judge very quickly on what's called a motion. And the motion judge dismissed the employee's motion to find this provision unenforceable and held that the termination provision was certainly enforceable. And the motions court judge said, well, look, it provides more than the minimum entitlements. 2 weeks per year of service absolutely does. So why would it be unenforceable? The employee was arguing it didn't refer to benefits. Under the Employment Standards Act, in Ontario, you're entitled to benefits throughout the course of the notice period. Well, so what? It doesn't say that. The employer actually provided benefits for a period, I believe in this case, that may have been in excess of the statutory notice period. And in any event, it was clear that they said, in effect, the intent of that last line above was we're going to comply with the Employment Standards Act. But it wasn't apparently perfect language, at least as we'll see. But the motions court judge says, look, they clearly weren't intending by that language to contract out of the Employment Standards Act, which you're not allowed to do. If you try to do that, it's unenforceable. Does that provision above look like they're trying to contract out of the Employment Standards Act? Heavens no. But that goes to the Court of Appeal. So what happens at the Court of Appeal? Well, I didn't give you long to think about that one because I know you know what the answer is. The motion judge got it wrong, according to the Court of Appeal. Why? Why? Because they didn't identify benefit continuance in that termination provision. What? The idea of, and we don't have the time to go through all the legalese Supreme Court of Canada decisions, but the Supreme Court of Canada a number of years ago said, hey, you can't contract out of minimum standards. But if where it's clear you haven't attempted to contract out, why should the court imply a provision or imply that the employer was intending to contract out of the Employment Standards Act? But that's what the Court of Appeal did. Well, if you don't have benefits in there, well, then you're intending not to comply with minimum standards. And in fact, what the motions court judge said, I believe it's in this motions court judge said, all these decisions that throw out these termination provisions, you might as well be just felling all the forests in Canada because it's useless. Do you want to append the entire Employment Standards Act to every employment agreement? It makes no sense. But that's what the Court of Appeals said. So while the omission was likely not an overt attempt to contract out of minimum standards, the court interpreted the contract against the employer, found the clause as attempting to contract out of minimum standards, and thus not enforceable. So even though the employer continued the benefits throughout the statutory notice period, it may have been beyond that, I don't recall, it was found to be unenforceable. The court also held that since the provision did not provide for a lump sum payment for severance pay, apart from the notice, so this is even saying, hey, listen, what about, and some lawyers have argued, what about if it doesn't include vacation pay? In Ontario, you have to pay vacation pay over the notice period. Well, if you don't say that in the termination provision, is it unenforceable? Alex and I are standing on our soapbox here because it just doesn't make sense, but that's what the Court of Appeal found. So what are our lessons? Our lessons are always ensure, and that's why we're here, excuse me, that your termination provisions provide for notice, pay in lieu of notice, benefit continuance, statutory severance pay, and that's even if you're not a severance pay employer. You want to make sure it includes that. Always include a statement that the employer will receive no less than their minimum statutory entitlements, the saving language. Always, always that should be there. One piece of good news. So perhaps I can talk a little more quietly now because I was getting excited there, as you can hear. At least the court came to a very reasonable conclusion as it relates to when the employee sort of signs, as it were, the employment agreement. So in this case, the court didn't find the entire contract to be unenforceable based upon the fact that it was signed after the start date. And all of us, you know, we always tell you to make it, get it signed before the start date. And that's, of course, the best practice. But in this case, the employee had the employment agreement before the start date. And so the court said, well, the fact that you signed it after, so what? You had and understood the terms prior to commencement. So we're not going to accept any argument that suggests the contract unenforceable simply because it was signed after. No way. With that, at least, is a little piece of good news.
We have a bonus case for you all, and it deals with overseas employment. And it's just briefly here because it's important. There's a court in BC recently ruled that a lawsuit commenced in Canada by Eritrean miners, those are miners in the African country of Eritrea, was allowed to proceed in Canada despite the fact that the employees were working in Eritrea and were not even Canadian. The facts, as they are alleged, and this is still allegations, were that they were forced to work in the mine owned by a Canadian mining company contrary to human rights conventions under international law. This is the first time ever that foreign claimants have been able to proceed to a trial in a lawsuit against a Canadian company for alleged human rights abuses overseas. And so while the court hasn't ruled on the validity of the claim, the Canadian company initially brought a motion seeking that the courts rule that didn't have jurisdiction to hear the matter, but they are in fact going to proceed despite the fact that none of the employees are Canadian citizens, none of the employees worked in Canada, but there was some nexus to Canada by virtue of the fact that the mining company was Canadian. So we'll keep you updated on that, but just keep in mind that there is still possible legal ramifications in Canada for things that happen overseas. So even though we alluded to perhaps there's a nice case about vacations in Caribbean, fun times is not fun for Canadian entities that operate throughout the world, and that there are going to be potential lawsuits brought in Canada, probably a more friendly place to bring lawsuits in Canada for things that happen overseas. And I know we have a couple more minutes left, so I'll pass it over back to Stu to do a quick little wrap up, and we'll go from there. But thank you again for I'm spending your lunch hour with us today.
Thanks, Alex. And so by way of concluding remarks, perhaps one of the perspectives you could have on this is it's self-serving from our perspective. And why do I say that? Because I'm sure some of you at times get frustrated with us when we use words like, it's going to depend on the circumstances. And there's not absolute clarity attached to that. And as you can see here, there's a reason for that. Our Court of Appeal arguably has even been inconsistent with its own rulings. It's certainly overturning lower court decisions. So we have, on an ongoing basis in the employment law arena, you have unpredictability and uncertainty. And so that's why it becomes extremely important in situations that have any likelihood of potential litigation for an exhaustive consideration of the relevant facts and circumstances, because it will provide us with the best opportunity to understand and communicate to you the risks given this landscape of uncertainty. So how do we reduce, though? What's the best way ultimately to reduce some of this or a significant amount of this uncertainty? Well, valid employment agreements, absolutely fundamental. Fundamental. And for those of you, and I know some of you are out there, we love you all, and you know that, but sometimes we learn that you've decided to provide employees with employment agreements that we've previously provided you with, but you don't ask us to get involved because you think, it's quick, I don't have the time, I don't want to spend the 6 minutes on the phone call, and then lo and behold, down the line, we find out there are some inadequacies in that circumstance where you used a prior employment agreement to issue to a new employment agreement or in the context of a promotion or what have you. So we urge you to always talk to us because, as you can see, it can turn quickly in a direction that's not favorable to you. So that's why we say make sure you get advice before doing things. Once again, as you know, we're friendly to talk to. We can typically deal with a given situation very expeditiously. It won't take long, but it can make a real big difference. Having the human resources infrastructure in place is absolutely fundamental, not only fundamental from a human capital standpoint, but fundamental from an organizational standpoint and perhaps even down the line a transactional standpoint for the organization. It will attach a premium to the share price without question. So we urge you to make sure you're doing that properly because human capital is your biggest asset typically or one of the most important. So it's important that it be properly treated to ensure the maximum ROI on that asset. So once again, we thank you all. I thank Alex especially for having put together this very interesting and, for me, incredibly entertaining hour to talk to you about some of the new developments. And as always, we ask you to speak to an E2R advisor with any questions or concerns. Once again, we remind you that April 27th will be the next one. You'll hear about what that topic's going to be about shortly. And as Alex indicates, thank you so much for spending your time with us. We certainly appreciate it.